Okay, hello. My name is TJ Myhill. I'm an attorney here in Atlanta, and I work with intellectual property, trademarks specifically, and internet and technology law. So I'm here today to talk to you a little bit about legal issues regarding trademarks and some trademarks that have been of particular interest to people at this con in the last year or so. And we're going to be discussing some of those today, as well as any other things you guys want to talk about. We're pretty free form and happy to answer questions. Lee?
Good afternoon. My name is Lee Anderson. This is my first ever participation in a panel, so please be gentle. And I am.
Don't tell him that.
Okay. So my day job, I work as an analyst for the Boeing Company in South Carolina. In my spare time, I volunteer for multiple nonprofit organizations, including 501c3. I serve as the national treasurer for the Patriot Guard Riders Incorporated. The PGR is a 100% volunteer, federally registered 501c3 dedicated to ensuring dignity and respect for fallen military heroes. And so I am here to shed a little bit of a outside light on a trademark issue that I've had a front row seat to for the past couple of years.
So I think the best way to handle this is I'm going to start out by telling you a little bit about what a trademark is. Then Lee can tell you his, as he said, real-world experience, the user perspective, as it were, of the trademark. And while we have a little bit of a grasp of that, I think you guys will be able to understand some of the issues on the two or three specific subjects we'll talk about with regards to cease and desist letters and trademark infringement claims that have come up since the last DragonCon. So let's start out with what a trademark is. And I want to start there because this is a pretty smart track. You all are pretty smart people, and I'm sure a lot of people in here know what a trademark is. But I know a lot of attorneys who think they know what a trademark is. And so I'd rather make sure we all have a similar understanding. A trademark is anything that you use to identify your brand, your company, your source of goods. In other words, when I see this trademark, I know that it comes from the same source. It's an identifier for a consumer to know where they're getting their things from. So when I see a Rolex, I know I'm getting a real Rolex and not that thing the guy in New York sold me for $5. That's the purpose of it. A trademark is your brand identifier. It can be your name, your logo, your slogan. So for example, Nike is a trademark. The swoosh is a trademark. Just Do It is a trademark. But a trademark can also be anything else that identifies your company, something that you use as part of your branding. So brown is a trademark for UPS, both the word and the color. Orange is a trademark used by Home Depot. Everything they have is orange. Everything they put out is orange, so that when you see something orange, you know that you're supposed to go pick that up at Home Depot and not Lowe's. Sounds can be trademarks. The you hear that little jingle after the Intel word every time. That's their trademark. Harley Davidson tried to trademark their engine noise. It didn't work because somebody else had a V-twin before them. But it had it not been prior use, they'd have been able to do that because a sound can certainly be a source identifier. So anything that says, I see that, I hear that, I recognize that thing, and that thing says to me that I'm getting a product from a company I know. I know my polo shirt. I know my Coca-Cola. I know my Coca-Cola is not my Pepsi-Cola. All of these things are your trademark. A trademark is not an idea. It's got to be actually used in commerce. It's got to be something that you use on your branding. Ideas are not at all protected by trademark. A trademark is not going to protect your 45-page, marketing materials. That's a copyright. It only protects short phrases, slogans, logos, trademarks. Trademarks is that's redundant. Slogans, logos, or short phrases to identify your company. So that's what trademarks are. And what they do is just what I said. They identify where the source comes from. So as long as you're not going to be confused as to the source, you can use the same trademark as somebody else. Delta Airlines is not going to be confused with Delta Faucets, because no one's going to think the faucet manufacturer went into the flying business, I hope, because otherwise no one's flying on that plane. So that's fine. Domino's, right? You can have Domino's pizza, you can have Domino's sugar, because no one thinks the sugar guy went into the pizza business or that the pizza company started making sugar. You don't have a confusion as to source on those things. Those are two completely different brands. But if I call myself Nike and I start making sweatbands, I'm going to get sued. Because even though Nike is a shoe company, they've expanded so much and expanded into so many different brands, it's likely they're going to expand into other forms of athletic wear. And I'm sure they already make sweatbands, so that's kind of a bad point. But anything that you might be likely to expand into, if you have a mark, I can't use a mark in anything that would be likely to cause consumer confusion. That's the standard of question. Is there a likelihood of confusion among the relevant consumers that this is going to come from the same source? So trademarks aren't completely exclusive. You're exclusive in that you can protect your mark in your area for your category of goods or services. And other people can use your exact same trademark in different categories or in different areas. But if they transfer into yours, or it's likely they will, you can prevent that. So now that we have a little bit of an idea, although I did see some questions go up, so let's hit those before we go to Lee. There was one over here, now there's one back here. So let's start tossing the box around. What's the difference? Well, hang on, we're recording, so we need to actually be talking into the box.
Can you clarify the difference in protections between trademark and service mark?
There really isn't one. A trademark is generally identifies a good, a source of goods. A service mark identifies the source of a service. So, for example, Nike again. Nike sells you a product. They don't come to your house and do anything for you. If they did, I'd weigh 180 pounds. But a plumber doesn't actually sell you any products. A plumber provides a service. But Nike and the plumber can both protect their logo or their brand name or their trade name. There's really no legal distinction between how they work or how they're protected or how they're filed or how they're created. They're just identifying a different nature of product.
You used the phrase trying to establish a trademark in regard to Harley Davidson. I was wondering if you could expand upon that, whether or not a trademark is created through just solely its existence and it can only be proven in court, or whether or not there is documents that you can file preemptively to create your trademark, or what is the process of trying to create the idea of a trademark?
Sure, that's a good question. Lee, I think we'll get into this a little bit more too, but let me just tell you generally the process. It is created by use. You are using it in commerce. As long as you are using it in commerce, you have rights to protect that trademark. If it is a protectable mark, it will be protected by your use. And what I mean by if it's protectable is there are some marks that are protectable. There are some things that you use as a trade name or a brand name that aren't protectable because they're either generic or they're simply descriptive of your product and might ultimately get some protection, but you have to prove that people associate it with you. So, for example, if I was the Atlanta trademark guy, I could maybe trademark that over time if I could show that ultimately most of the relevant consumers heard Atlanta trademark guy and thought of me. But right now, they probably wouldn't. So even if I'm using it, I'm not going to be entitled to full trademark protection until I can show that understanding, which is called secondary meaning. I've developed a secondary meaning in that Atlanta trademark guy means not just what it says, but also me specifically in the minds of most consumers. So that's how you create a trademark. You create a trademark by using it as a brand that people understand as a brand. Now, when you use it that way, you get protection where you're using it. So I would only get protection probably here in Georgia in that, because I'm only using my services here. But if I start giving services in in the Southeast. Maybe I expand out to that corner of the country. I don't get nationwide protection until I can show that I'm using it and people have that same understanding all around the country. If somebody in Wyoming thinks of the Atlanta trademark guy, why am I stuck in Wyoming today? It's like the third time I've used it as an example. I don't know. But if somebody in Wyoming thinks of me as the Atlanta trademark guy, well, then I get rights in Wyoming too. But it's going to be a long time before somebody in Wyoming thinks of me as the Atlanta trademark guy, because they probably don't think a whole hell of a lot about the Atlanta trademark guy, period. So I don't get rights in Wyoming by my use here in Georgia. I can get rights in Wyoming by filing a federal trademark registration, showing that I use my mark in interstate commerce, that people in, you know, I serve customers here in Georgia and Tennessee and Alabama and South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida. So I have interstate commerce, and I can file myself federally. Once I do that, I get nationwide protection. So even if that guy in Wyoming has never heard of me, I can stop someone else in Wyoming from being the Atlanta trademark guy. That's doesn't create the right, though. Filing your registration doesn't create your trademark. It gives you some additional protections. It gives you some additional understandings. But unless you have actual use in commerce that you can prove that you're using it and making it your mark, that federal registration is a waste of money and paper time. So it's something that doesn't have any greater authority than your ultimate underlying use. Now, just to be full disclosure, there's something you can file federally called an intent to use that gives you some protection, but that costs you the same as filing a regular mark, and you still have to come back and prove you're actually using it before it gives you any rights. An intent to use can lock down your rights for a little while so no one else can come in and use your name while you're getting your company up and running. But unless you actually get that company up and running, start using it as a trademark, and prove by more paperwork to the trademark office that you are in fact using that mark in commerce, it will die. So the paperwork creates no trademark rights. It memorializes your rights and gives you some additional benefits, but it all comes out of that core use. Do we have any other questions before we go to Lee? All right, well, let's talk then about how they're actually created and what happens when you have a bit of a fight over them.
Right. Well, really quickly, just by a show of hands, has anybody in the room here ever volunteered for a nonprofit? Okay. Has anybody ever created and formed a nonprofit? Okay. Awesome. So you'll be the most appreciative of this. So the Patriot Guard was originally formed in 2005 to help shield mourning families from disruptions at the funeral services. It initially started with a group of American Legion riders in Kansas, and one of the people who attended one of those services was from Oklahoma. He decided to take the concept national, and the original group was called the Patriot Guard. He decided to call this organization, national organization, Patriot Guard Riders. So he added the word riders, and then he began spreading word about the organization electronically through internet forums, motorcycle forums, and so forth, that the organization was being formed and expanding, and the desire was to take it nationwide. It began to gain traction, and it expanded very quickly. A lot of people decided that, you know, hey, we'd like to be identifiable at these services. And so he created went to a vendor and got a patch made up with a logo and the words Patriot Guard Riders and also the words Riding with Respect. As the organization began to grow, they actually made a board of directors with three people. He was the president. And then about a year and a half into things, there was a Patriot Guard store which was selling merchandise, T-shirts, patches, hats, banners, flags, so on and so forth. About a year into it, it was discovered that, number one, the organization had never been registered as a 501c3. Number two, it was found that the marks that had never been trademarked or registered with the Federal Trademark Board. And so, number three, it was found that the person was operating that store for profit as the sole proprietor. And so he, the board, the remainder of the board members voted him out, and he announced his intent to close his store once his inventory was depleted. And then the new board members, they actually expanded from three to five board members, and when it was discovered that they that had not registered as a 501c3 and that the marks had not been trademarked, they did so immediately. The day that they applied for their federal trademark via the electronic registration system, 3 hours later, the former president attempted to register the trademarks as well. So the Federal Trademark Board put a hold on the application from the organization, saying there's a challenge to it. And I'll cut through a lot of red tape here. The case went on for nearly 5 years, when normally, I think TJ can corroborate that something like that typically takes less than a year. This drug on for 5 years. After a lot of back and forth, the Trademark Board rendered their decision and indicated that even though he was using personal funds when he first formed the store for the organization, first formed the store, he was doing so on behalf of the organization. And so, therefore, all the marks were owned by the organization. And so they made the decision that the corporation owned the marks and that he no longer had any rights to them. Earlier this year, we had actually about a year and a half ago, we had another organization that was in the state of Michigan that they decided they wanted to do their own thing, but in the process they used the name Patriot Guard as part of their name. And we sent several cease and desist letters. They ignored them until we had fully registered trademarks approved by the trademark board. And even then, they still were attempting to utilize them. They wanted to negotiate. And long story short, we had to file suit in order to get their attention hard enough to where they decided, you know, our purpose is to raise funds for veterans. We'd rather not spend money fighting this. And so they agreed to a settlement of changing their name. So those are a couple of real-world experiences that I have been front row seat for about the past 2 years. So hopefully, if any of you are working with nonprofits or you choose to form a nonprofit for your organization in the future, keep in mind that if you're doing it for the benefit of the organization, it's for the organization. You don't own the marks yourself. So, question.
Could you explain how the Trademark Commission works?
Well,
do you want to take a crack at that, or do you want me to?
I'll take a little bit, and you can jump in. Basically, if an a person or an organization wants to trademark an item, a slogan, a service, you fill out a form. It can be done electronically. You pay the fee. And they register it. There are certain waiting periods to where, and this is what happened in the first case with the PGR, is as long as nobody either attempts to register a similar mark or challenges the mark that you have registered, then it's typically approved probably within 90 days or so.
Not quite that fast.
Okay. All right. So, there's a period of time where there is it's open for comment or that kind of thing.
There's what happens in the process. There is a number of delays. They're actually for several different purposes. One of them is just because the government's slow. But what happens when you file it is exactly that. It goes up. You fill out the form. You register it. You file it electronically and you pay your fee. Then it goes to a trademark examining attorney. That attorney, it's going to take about 4 to 6 months for them to get back to you. They can get back to you earlier, but they don't. As Lee said, they're waiting to see if there's something else that comes in, but they're also making sure nothing else conflicts, because what their job is to make sure that you're not trying to register something that already exists or that someone else is already using. So they're going to look at your mark. They're going to look at your categories. They're going to look at what you are claiming to use it in. They're going to see if you actually use it. They're going to see if your specimen is right. They're going to see if your logo or graphics are acceptable. They're going to make sure that your application is clear and understandable. And they're going to make sure that there's nothing else that is similar or confusingly similar to your mark. If any of those things occur, you'll get one letter back. You'll get what's called an office action letter that says, here are the things you need to fix. And, you know, or here's why we're denying your mark. And if you think we're wrong, tell us why. And then you have 6 months to respond to that. But if they don't find a problem with your mark, that's when you get what Lee said. You get a letter that says, you're okay. We're going to go ahead and put this out for publication. And that publication then is a final chance for people to oppose it. So it's one thing to do like they've done, where you have two marks filed contemporaneously for the same thing. Then the trademark office knows there's a problem. But the objection period is there so that when I put it out there, it's published. We're all supposed to be looking at those things to make sure our marks aren't infringed. And if we see something that we think is a problem, hey, that's kind of just like my mark, then we have the opportunity to call that to the office's attention. The reason that exists is because there's some guy in Wyoming, I'm going to use it again, who's running his business, right, and doesn't really have a registered mark and isn't really doing anything with it, but suddenly realizes that this thing you're trying to register infringes on the thing he's been using for 15 years. Well, the guy at the Patent and Trademark Office in Washington doesn't know about that guy in Wyoming either. So the notice period is to give him a chance to tell us about him and see if we can resolve that issue. That's how the process, it's sort of a multi-step process with opportunity for objection at several levels. Now, as a practical matter, the Patent Office and Trademark Office is full of examining attorneys who get paid a fairly decent wage to find problems with your application. And so it's been my experience that no matter what you do, someone will find problems with your application, because they want to keep their job. So very, very rarely does it go directly to the publication stage. Mostly you get an office action letter back, even if it's just, hey, we just want to confirm X, or please disclaim this, you know, ridiculous word or something else. And you don't know what you're getting until you send it up there. I had an application one time. I was applying for somebody's mark. I had the mark, just the words, and the words plus the logo. And those usually go to the same examining attorney for this very reason. This one got a screw up, and it didn't. One went to the examining attorney, one went to, the logo went to another examining attorney. One examining attorney said, everything's fine, looks great to us, we don't have any problems, it's going straight to publication. The other guy sent me back a 10-issue letter. Same exact mark. So, it's all down to who you draw when you push the submit button. But either way, I mean, even the 10-issue letter was something that was very easily resolved, but it's something you got to go jump through the extra hoops to get to that publication phase. All right, we got a couple here. Hang on.
So in your last example, the guy in Wyoming who has a service or a trademark he's been using for a while, mm-hmm. and somebody's filing against that in the publication, mm-hmm. somebody else is trying to use that, where is he supposed to be looking? And how likely is it that the attorneys in the trademark office are likely to find that? So basically, how diligent do I need to be to make sure somebody's not trademarking what I'm using?
The attorneys in the trademark office are going to find it? Very slim. That anyone else is going to find it. That's what the guy who's getting ready to file is supposed to be doing, is looking for other people who exist who might be in his area. A lot of people don't do that. So the publication, look, I'm going to be blunt. You're never going to see the publication. That's just fact. But what you do is that publication, it's going to be in the trademark database probably 6 to 12 months before it gets to publication. So the easiest way to make sure no one's using your mark or infringing your mark is go to the USPTO.gov, find the little button that says TESS, that's the trademark search, and just go through TESS, put in your name, put in variations of your name, make sure nobody's using it. You can do that every, 6 months. You'll probably catch most things that are going to be a problem. And when you see that, you wait for it to go to public. You keep an eye on it, wait for it to go to publication so that you can file your opposition at the right time.
Thank you.
Crazy Eyes up here had a question.
Yep. Up here.
All right.
Yeah. Now we need the box.
Need the box. Okay. Yeah. Where do I speak into the box?
Talk into the box.
Yep. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. All right. I came because I have a very specific issue with confusion of likeness.
Mm-hmm.
I have already watched. All right. First of all, I started an advertising agency in 1993. I have experience in the advertising industry since 1984. So I'm familiar with a lot of the copyright infringement, a lot of the trademark infringement, all that stuff. So here I am trying to look at trademarking my zombie persona. And it just happens to be Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah,
so
good luck with that.
I've already been to that the
Test.
Database that you were looking at, and it's trademarked as George Romero's Dawn of the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm Dawn Compton, a.k.a. Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, but I can't make TJ Myhill's Coca-Cola.
Well,
I mean it's one of those things that's a good example though. That the fact that you're a zombie is what makes it a problem, because that's exactly what he had. Now, if Dawn of the Dead had been about some nuclear apocalypse where everybody just died and didn't come back as zombies, then your zombie could probably be Dawn of the Dead. Or if there was some other part of Dawn that was dead, we might be okay.
Well,
but
here's where the differences come in. All right, I am an individual. I'm looking to trademark it under my name, whereas his is George Romero's, just Dawn of the Dead. Mine's as an individual. And
yeah.
The fact, and the scissors is what I'm trying to avoid, people copying the scissors.
Well, it's one of those things that you could probably trademark the scissors more than you. Yeah, the name, you can use your own name, and so we couldn't stop you from using Dawn. And you might be able to protect the scissors. We'd have to look into that a little more. But you're never, ever, ever going to get Dawn of the Dead, because that's too even goes beyond the level of trademark, and it rises to the level of famous marks. And once you get up into famous marks, which is a fairly high level, so most things don't get there, but Coke does, Pepsi does.
Thank
probably,
you.
You know, Dawn. The Living Dead is popular enough that it's probably going to be deemed famous. And famous marks get just even an extra level of protection. So it's going to be something that it would be very difficult for you to distinguish enough that you'd be able to use that. Now, because it's your name, you could use Dawn something, but...
This is the business card I'm using,
well,
and that's the logo mark. But the only other thing I can add to it at this point is that my agent happens to be friends with George Romero.
Well, if he gives you permission, you can use it.
Well, that was my next question.
Yes, okay? Yeah, absolutely.
He says that George Romero would probably get a kick out of it, and everything that I do where I tell people that I am Dawn, and I always use the quotation marks, Dawn of the Dead, with most emphasis on Dawn, He thinks George Romero would actually get a kick out of it and see it as more promotion for his franchise.
And in that case, you can always get someone's permission. You also kind of get into the question of fair use. And I wasn't really going to go ahead and throw the box back at him.
Oh.
I wasn't really going to get into the issue of fair use today, because it's one of those things that is there is no answer. I could talk to you for 7 hours and we wouldn't understand fair use by the end of the time. But it is something that means that if I'm using your mark, but I'm using it in a way that is is fair. It doesn't hurt your business. It's not really impacting your, you know, no one's hiring me instead of watching your DVD is basically the argument you're making. Right. No one's gonna say, well, I could go to Netflix and download Dawn of the Dead, or I could hire Dawn to wander around my living room. So it's not, it's probably something that you could, they're not going to register it, but could you use it without being sued is a, well, and that's a trick. No, you can't use it without being sued because fair use is a defense to your litigation. So, but would George Romero ever sue you over it? That's the question. But would the trademark office probably approve it? Not without a very nice letter from George Romero saying it was okay.
Let's,
yeah. I'd try for that first. Yeah. And then if not, you just use it and hope he doesn't sue you. Yeah. There you go.
Let's just be glad that your last name isn't Walker.
Question that way. Blue shirt guy.
I just wanted the name of that website where you can check the if someone else is using your trademark.
Sure. Go ahead and pass it there down, and I'll tell you. It's USPTO.gov. USPTO, Patent and Trademark Office, .gov. Yeah.
Is that federal or just state?
No, it's federal. There are state registrations for trademarks, and if you're using something that's purely intrastate, as I said, federal trademark has to be used in interstate commerce. But if you're using it purely just in Georgia, like if you're just in Georgia, you might be able to just register in Georgia. Oh, well, then you're out of luck. But the idea of state law, states have their own trademark laws too. So if you don't qualify for federal registration, you can always look to your own state protection.
My question's real fast too. Is there the equivalent of a Creative Commons license for trademarks? So for instance, I run a nonprofit that does business as the Academy Theater. Can I have a Creative Commons that lets some people use the Academy Theater, but not just anybody?
Not really. You can give licenses to whoever you want as an owner. Academy Theater is another one of those ones that probably is going to require a lot of secondary meaning to get any legitimate protection from them. But as far as letting other people use it, you can give people permission. But just having a generic license that yeah, that's a tricky one because there's a thing in trademark law called naked licensing. And what that means is if you give just a license to use it without restrictions, you're really not protecting your mark. You've kind of made it generic. The same goes with, I mean, how would you normally do it? You just say, I'm not going to sue that guy. I like that guy. I'm going to send the other guy a cease and desist. I don't like that guy. But if you're very particular about who you sue, you again run the risk that you're not really protecting your trademark, and your mark goes generic. So it's a tricky thing. It's best to go ahead and have something in writing between everybody you want to use your mark.
So does vigilance matter?
Yeah.
Does vigilance matter?
It does. It absolutely does. Aspirin is a trademark of Bayer, but Bayer didn't do a very good job of protecting it. So now we all use aspirin, and it is something that has gone generic, whereas Xerox is very, very, very protective and very vigilant of telling people that they don't Xerox things, and so they have not gone generic, despite the fact that we all kind of use the word Xerox for everything. So it is absolutely important to be vigilant on your trademarks. A couple more questions.
Hi, so I've been using a service mark since the 20th century for my business.
Okay.
And during that time, I've discovered that there is a company with a similar name in a different market area, in a similar business, but we're separated enough by market area and by service that neither one of us is going to go,
right,
give up your name. But in the case that other company would decide to try and move into my market area by, say, opening, they're a New York company, and they decide to open a Chicago office,
right,
which is my market area, who's going to win, Godzilla or Mothra on that one? I've been in Chicago doing it using my service mark, registered as an Illinois corporation. They've been using their service mark very similar in New York as a New York corporation. So if they attempt to come in,
you're going to win.
I'm going to win because
data first use.
Yeah, what it comes down to is when you have that idea of multiple market areas. So let's go back to Mr. Wyoming, the guy who had that one little business, and I'm registering my national thing. I can register that national mark, right? He can object, he can oppose it, but what that means is I won't have rights in Wyoming, or at least the little part of Wyoming that he's using his business. Because I can have rights nationwide, but he pre-exists me in Wyoming. He doesn't use it anywhere else, so he can't stop me in Utah, he can't stop me in Ohio, but he can stop me in Wyoming. And so that idea of where your market is and your first use in the marketplace, it all comes down to what Lee just said, the data first use of the mark. Who was the first one to use it there? And so you're the first one to use it in Chicago. They come into your market, you can prohibit it.
Now, just to make things confusing, at about the same time, I registered a domain name and found some collisions on the name, again, with similar types of company, mm-hmm. and jiggered my domain names around, my name choice around, until we no longer collided. So does use on the internet as a domain name constitute a market area?
Well, that is a really, really tricky question. And in fact, I was just a co-author on an article about that very thing, because there really isn't an answer. Courts are treating it kind of differently. The internet, where you are on the internet is something courts haven't really figured out yet. You know, are you where your basic brick and mortars are located, or are you in fact nationwide because your domain name is worldwide? I don't have an answer for that one, because that's something that is still up in the air. It's you'd love to think that the internet's been around long enough that our laws would have caught up, but we haven't. We totally haven't, especially in intellectual property. By the way, I'd like to point out that I'm telling a lot of people the exact answer to their specific question. I am not giving anyone legal advice, and I practice only in Georgia. And if you if you take my advice and somebody comes into from New York and sues you and you lose, don't tell me that I committed malpractice.
You're not licensed in Illinois, so there's no
way. I am not. So yeah. All right. One more question. Let's talk about some of the specifics that we got into this last year. I don't want to run out of time before we talk about the carpet guys.
I guess this is asking personal opinions, but I'm actually an attorney, and we argue round and round and round if the current trademark laws we have are too extensive, because Coke protects not just the whole Coke logo, but they can fight you off on color and font and even the slant of your font. And it gets to the point where someone had an example where they were arguing about the angle of an H, mm-hmm. because the angle was 12 degrees and someone was using that H and they were claiming, you know, what is your opinion? Have we just protected too much that we're really defeating the purpose, which was, you know, to induce commerce, not to inhibit commerce?
That's a really tricky question. First off, it is a matter of opinion. So I guess, you know, I can have the same opinion. It doesn't really matter. I think that probably a lot of our intellectual property laws are too restrictive. I think that about copyright. I think that about trademark. I think that about patent. Okay. But I also think that the problem with making them less restrictive is that then we lose some of the benefit that they're there for. We've kind of lost some of the benefit that they're there for by being protected to such an extent that people can use them for ill purposes. Patent trolls, trademark trolls, copyright trolls. Yeah. Those things exist because these things exist. At the same time, without them, there's anarchy. Yeah. I work in that too. that's the question is, do I think that what we have is perfect? No. Mm-hmm. But what's better? You know, I mean, what's the better alternative? Where do we back it down to without backing it too far? And that's a really, really tricky question, and certainly is something that can be covered very well over beer.
No, please. If you're ever in Tallahassee, come down to the Young Lawyers Association. We spent 6 hours. They kicked us out of a bar.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the things that did happen. Let's get to pie and the carpet guys, because those are the two most interesting ones. Who saw the carpet guys last year, the carpet commando guys? Those were fantastic, weren't they?
Yeah.
So for those of you who didn't see them, What someone did is they made entire commando suits out of the Marriott carpet material, or at least the pattern. Yeah, the pattern was on the material that they used. They didn't actually wear carpet. I'm hot enough in this shirt. So they crawled around on the floor of the Marriott, and it was fantastic. It was incredibly well done. And so right after the con, they got a cease and desist letter. Now, in fairness, I never saw the cease and desist letter, so I don't know for sure whether it was a copyright cease and desist or a trademark cease and desist. But it could have been a trademark, so we're going to talk about it. The difference would have been, a copyright cease and desist would have been, hey, that's the design we use. We created that design. We're the owners of that graphic design. And since I own that graphic design, and maybe it's registered, maybe it's not, I don't know, I'm the copyright owner of that graphic design, and you need to stop. Trademark would be, hey, that design is something that people associate with the Marriott. When you see that, you know that that's the Marriott carpet. Or it was actually the carpet company who sent it. That's our carpet. That when you see this carpet, you know it came from crappy Carpet USA. Because, man, this is ugly stuff. But let's assume that this was nice carpet and you saw it and you said, oh, I know where that comes from. That's that, you know. So that's the trademark aspect. You see the pattern and you know where it comes from, as opposed to the copyright aspect, which is just, I'm protecting this pattern because I'm the guy who actually drew it, or I paid the guy who actually drew it in this case. And so they got that cease and desist letter. It never went anywhere. It didn't get sued. I read a couple articles that said they did, but they didn't. They didn't get sued. They just got the cease and desist. But when they got the cease and desist, the company who made that fabric for them pulled that pattern, because that's ultimately the remedy in any trademark litigation, is an injunction. If you're successful, you get an injunction. If you're really, really successful, maybe you also get some money. But the sort of default remedy is that guy has to stop using it. And so that's just what they did. They just went ahead and pulled it in this case. But the question is, again, does that go too far? Is that too protective? Were they really infringing on anyone's trademark? Did anyone see those guys and say, I bet they work for the carpet company?
I'd like to buy some carpet.
So that's the question. I'm not using it as a trademark. Can I use your trademark thing not as a trademark? And the answer is yes, of course you can. Because you're not creating any customer confusion. Nobody saw those guys and was confused. They didn't see the carpet guys and think, they must be sponsored by Dacron. Or that they were employees of, or that they were owned by, or that they, you know, that there was no confusion on any relevant consumer that those guys were here to sell me carpet. So that's the question. Is that even a valid cease and desist? Probably not. But they got a nasty letter from a big company, and that big company is going to sue you. And I might win, but it's going to cost me $75,000 to win. And at the end of the day, well, I'm just not going to wear that costume anymore. I'm going to pull the fabric. Because, I mean, that's what they do. It's a bullying tactic that people use to stop commerce or stop other people from using things that aren't really infringing their mark. Let's go ahead and get a couple questions. I'll get to the pie thing because it's the exact same issue.
Yeah. It was my understanding that
Got to talk to the box.
Just to clarify, it was my understanding from the news stories at the time that they were offering to sell that pattern or fabric with that pattern on it to other people to recreate the costume on their own.
Yeah,
and
yes.
That was what prompted the letter, not their use of it, but their intention to resell it.
Well, sure, people care a lot more when you're starting to make money from it, but it's still not necessarily. Again, this is 100% my opinion. I am not the guy in the black robe. I don't get to make the ultimate decisions, but TJ Myhill, attorney at law, thinks that's not a trademark infringement because you're not using it as a source identifier. You know, again, if that fabric, people see bolts of fabric. There's a little more question about maybe they came from the same manufacturer of the carpet. That's still tricky. That's still a very tricky area because it's a different material. It's a different thing. But you know, hey, it can go both ways, and either way, you're spending a lot of money defending it. So,
why don't we get the gentleman over on the far, against the far wall,
and we'll just circle it around.
Isn't the fact that it's a costume and not you're not selling the fabric on its own as fabric, wouldn't that be a different market?
No. I mean, yes. Is it a different market? Yes. But does that necessarily avoid a trademark infringement because it's a costume? No. Wear an Iron Man costume. You know that. Now, Marvel's not going to sue you if you wear an Iron Man costume to Dragon Con, but that's because Marvel is an asshole. Apparently, the carpet company decided to be a different approach there. But that's the thing. How you're using it. It may play into that fair use defense, but it's not necessarily going to create a situation where you're not infringing someone else's trademark. The issue is in here, is a costume similar enough to a carpet that's completing categories? And that, I think, ultimately was the core of your question. And no, I think not.
It's nothing that goes towards more opinion stuff, but does the requirement of such high vigilance in order to maintain the trademark lead to some of the bullying?
To some extent, I think it does. To some extent, you do get people who send cease and desist letters. I used to work for the firm that worked with White Wolf, and White Wolf had just a hell of a lot of trademarks. And so White Wolf sent out a lot of cease and desist letters because people made a bunch of stupid stuff that used White Wolf characters and White Wolf logos and White Wolf ideas, and there was just so much to protect and so many people who thought, that's really cool, I want to do something with it, that we were sending out letters all the time. And we started to get, you know, some feedback of, hey, aren't you guys being just over-aggressive? Well, but if we're not, and you're actually using my mark, and you're making a vampire movie about my vampires, I kind of got to protect that. I got to tell you stop. But again, if somebody, you know, dressed up as a Malkavian, White Wolf probably doesn't send you a letter. It's a question of, yes, I have to be vigilant in the things that actually impact my brand. But when someone's not competing with me, I have an obligation then to think, Is that actually infringement? I need to make that determination before I send the letter. If Domino's Pizza starts sending weekly letters to Domino's Sugar, they're not going to be seen as vigilant. They're going to be seen as people who are creating unnecessary litigation and be slammed for it. So it's a duty of the trademark owner to make sure that what they're trying to enjoin to stop people from doing is something that is actually impacting their use in commerce.
Is there a standard of degree of similarity? In other words, or is it entirely subjective based upon the judge that's sitting there?
Everything's subjective based upon the judge sitting there. Well, yes. I mean, the similarity issue is exactly the Domino's Pizza, Domino's Sugar thing. There has to be that likelihood of confusion, that people are going to be confused as to the source of the goods or services. And again, I guess talking around it, there's a chance that someone could say, I would believe the source of the bolt of cotton fabric with this pattern is the same as the source of the bolt of carpet fabric with this pattern. That's a much more clear argument than here's a suit made out of this pattern. There's some gray area, and it really does depend on how close you are to what the other guy's doing. But, you know, that's where you have to make that determination as a trademark owner of, do I send a letter now or not?
So in copyright, there's a provision for commentary and parody. Is there also in trademark room for commentary and parody?
Yeah, well, those both kind of fall under that fair use umbrella, and there is parody defense in trademark. It's not quite as clear cut as copyright, because copyright is easier to parody. I mean, it's I can write a parody song, I can write a parody novel, I can write, you know, a parody of another work that's clearly a parody of that work, or clearly a satire of you know, our current condition using that work. And those things are easy to see and to define. Parody of a trademark, that's a trickier one because you run into stuff like dumb Starbucks. Everybody remember the dumb Starbucks thing a few months ago? Probably no one walks into dumb Starbucks and thinks, "Oh, this is a Starbucks," right? But that's a you're using Starbucks as a brand selling coffee. I mean, it's a good thing that was a joke that only lasted a couple weeks because I think that would have been a fairly interesting thing to see play out because it is a parody, right? But you're still using it as an actual brand to do actual business and sell actual goods for actual money. And once you start getting into selling actual goods for actual money, it's hard to say you're a parody. So let's talk about pie. I could use some pie. Anybody have any pie? I like peach pie. Banana cream? All right. Oh, that pie. Yes, that's the one we're talking about. So somebody registered pie, and the trademark office let them. Well, they can, because they're using it for a very specific purpose. I can register anything I want as a trademark as long as I'm using it to identify the source of certain specific goods or services. So if I want to say that I am going to use pie as my logo in making t-shirts, pie shop, there you go. I want to use pie as my logo to start a pie shop. They can register that. It's perfectly legitimate to register. It's perfectly legal to use that brand identifier, right? And some people are even going to say, hey, that's pretty creative. I want to go to the pie shop. But I can protect it as far as the service of making baked goods or the product of actual pies that you buy, depending on whether I'm a caterer or a sales counter. I can't stop you from doing algebra because I own a pie shop. I can protect it in what I'm doing. Well, the guy who registered it, registered it as far as t-shirts. And so he has started sending out all the nasty letters to people who have pie on the front of their t-shirt. That, again, is a really, really bad idea because he owns pie. He owns pie in relation to clothing or t-shirts, and that's fine. He can do that. But that's to put right back here on this tag on your shirt to say, this is where I got my shirt from. Okay? This thing on the front, that thing, the Green Lantern didn't sell him his shirt. Right? I hope. So the fact that there's a big logo on the front center of your t-shirt does not tell me where that t-shirt came from. Okay, now it might in the case of I've got a giant Nike swoosh through here or I've got some enormous polo player or whatever, that because those have already been created as a mark, right? I already know that mark. That's being used specifically to say that shirt came from Nike. Okay? That's being used to say that shirt came from DC because DC has a trademark in that. But just putting it on there, that doesn't make that shirt come from the Green Lantern. You got to know where the shirt's coming from. And I don't, because the trademark on the shirt is Hanes, right? Not Marvel. Marvel may have its own sweatshop. I know I just called them not assholes, but maybe they have a sweatshop. Marvel may have its own sweatshop and make its own t-shirts, and in that case, fine. They can own that t-shirt too, and they can put Marvel back here on the tag, but just putting Thor on the front doesn't make it a Marvel-branded shirt. It makes it a shirt from Marvel with Thor on it that came from Hanes. So the pie symbol on the front of the shirt is not necessarily infringing the pie symbol that goes on your tag back here as the source identifier. In fact, the trademark office will deny your mark if what you say is, I'm using my mark, here it is on the center of my shirt. They'll say that's not good. That's purely decorative, and purely decorative features cannot be a source identifier. So if you want to say it's a decoration, but it also identifies source, you know, the little polo player here in the corner, right? The little Nike swoosh on the side of your polo shirt. You know, those things can be decoration and source identifier. But generally, they're going to look here. Generally, they're going to look here. They're not going to look here. So what happened with the Pi registration, he registered the mark. Perfectly fine. He then took his registration, hired some terrible attorney, and I know he's a terrible attorney because his letter said, my client owns the registration of these trademarks. You're using his registered trademarks. Therefore, we insist that you cease and desist all copyright infringement. Okay. Yeah. Yep. So we can presume this attorney may not be a trademark specialist. But the big issue is, did he infringe on the mark? It's the same question as the carpet guys. Am I using this Pi T-shirt to infringe your brand to try and make people believe that this is coming from you, or am I using this because I want to sell Math Geeks a T-shirt? And that's two very different things. The likelihood of confusion question is the ultimate key goal. Am I making people think that when you see that, okay, when I see that, I know Green Lantern, I know DC. If it says Pi, do I think it comes from that guy who registered it? No, I probably think, hey, there's a guy who can probably recite Pi from memory. 3.14159265335. So that's the issue there. And that again, it's one of those things where we see people overreaching and overstepping what I think their legitimate rights are and creating these problems that make people think, all right, trademarks are apparently stupid and we should get rid of the law entirely. Copyrights are too long, so they're stupid, we should get rid of the law entirely. Well, no, they're not. They're really, really important for what they do, but unfortunately, some people are just assholes. Right.
Yep.
Any other questions before we wrap up?
Yep.
Waldo has a...
I have a question. I work with a nonprofit that it has a really long name, and so we have like a shortened name that we go by.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a generic name. It's Chapel of Ease. It's a Google agency, it is. And but the point is, it's like we have like sister churches nearby because we're a historical site.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very defensive about like their name and being a Chapel of Ease also. And I just wonder, is there any use in us even attempting to protect us somehow from...
That's really fact specific. I don't think I'd be able to answer that in 5 minutes. I don't think I'd be able to answer that in the whole hour. It's just really going to be a very fat... Come see me afterwards, but that's going to be... Because of the nature of trademarks, it's going to be a very, very fact specific thing. How are you using it? How are they using it? What are you doing together? What are you doing separately? So maybe.
Well, I was thinking of, like, you know, FedEx is like the shortened term.
You can certainly protect the shortened form. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. You can certainly protect the shortened form. The question is, if other people are using something similar to that or creating issues with that, is there something that would prevent you from using that, perhaps even in its longer form, if there's other use? So yes, you can protect a shortened. You can protect FedEx as well as Federal Express. You can protect. I can't think of any other shortened.
Well, it's just a problem. It's just a problem when
you can protect IBM as well as International Business Machines. In fact, people probably know IBM more than International Business Machines.
Yeah, I guess the problem just run into is that when the shortened form becomes a generic-y kind of thing.
Yeah, you may fall into the category of, well, you may fall all the way to generic, but most things don't. You may fall into that area of descriptiveness. Let me just sort of give you a rundown of this. This is the last legal breakdown we'll give you is the the categories of trademarks. There are several categories that the law recognizes. There's fanciful or arbitrary marks. There are suggestive marks, descriptive marks, and generic marks. Generic marks can never be protected because they just are what they are. Glass, right? Microphone. So
no, Kleenex is trademarked.
Kleenex is trademarked. Tissue. Yes. Yeah, but that's the same Xerox problem. Things can fall to generic because everybody calls them that. But Xerox and Kleenex are very, very particular about making sure that you aren't using a Kleenex when you're using a non-Kleenex brand tissue. You're using a tissue. Aspirin did not do that. Aspirin is now a generic brand name. It was a brand name. It doesn't mean anything. That pill is not made of aspirin. Right? It was Bayer's trademark, but they let it go, so it's now generic. Descriptive is water holder, right? It says what it does. It does what it says, and there's no real reason why this water holder is different than this water holder, or that anyone associates either one of them with me. And that's where you get into that idea of having to make secondary meaning. Okay, if I'm the only person in the world who calls this a water holder, and I probably am, then sooner or later I'm going to develop rights in that, and people are going to associate that with me, and I'm going to be able to make it my registered trademark. Suggestive is something that is not descriptive, but still kind of suggests what it is. So, yeah. Thirst quencher, maybe, I don't know. So it's something that, this is a really hard thing. So, but that's exactly what they are. Suggestive marks are really, really, really hard things, because it's easy to say something's descriptive, it's easy to say something's fanciful, but where is that line between water holder and whatever the next level up suggestive thing is? That is a very, very difficult thing to determine, even for the people who are paid to do it at the trademark office, which is why you get a lot of letters back. So trying to suggest that something is suggestive as opposed to descriptive is a very difficult line to draw sometimes. Fanciful, on the other hand, is I call this Zymox, okay, or Farfig. No, Farfig Newton's already taken. Farfig Apple. Okay, I've just completely made up a word. It is what it is. That's immediately protective. That's immediately protectable because it doesn't mean anything, and there's nobody else using it, and it's a completely arbitrary assignment to this glass. So you can't. I'm going to protect that immediately because no one can object to my use. That's the reason suggestive and descriptive are so important, because suggestive is also immediately protectable. Descriptive requires secondary meaning. And so there's lots of arguments over where that line is. But that's the things that they have. So we've run out of time. I hope we've told you all the things about trademark that you didn't want to know.